Well, I thought of starting off by asking Casey to tell us all about apocalyptic genre and literature and stuff. Because you absorbed it all yesterday.
Yeah.
But then I thought, well, I'll just write it down. And we can go back over it for folks that came late or weren't here or whatever. So I just introduced the Book of Revelation yesterday by saying I don't read it like the news media or the film industry reads it. where the Book of Revelation, if we read it in its historical and generic or genre context, is really talking about the end of empire, not the end of the world. Now, if the empire is your world, then yes, your world is ending when empire ends. But it's also not talking about something in the future. For John the Seer, he was really talking to seven churches in Asia Minor, not about the return of Christ and the end of the world, but about the end of the Roman Empire because it was contrary to who God was and how God operates in the world. So those are the basics. The word apocalypse means reveal, revelation. If you want to talk about the end of things, you can use the word eschaton or eschatology, if you've heard that. That's the proper Greek word. So when anybody equates apocalypse with the end of the world, you can just say, no, 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 really, you're talking about eschaton. and then you get into this whole conversation that is often hard to get out of. So we talked about the apocalyptic genre, and I said that apocalyptic is a genre that we don't know how to read anymore. And it's more like a dreamscape where what you see in your dreams always symbolizes something else, and it's random things put together in random ways. It will have monsters. Apocalypse will, maybe not your dreams, but your an apocalyptic piece of literature or oral recounting will have monsters or creatures. It will have a regular ordering of the cosmos in levels and time and segments. And it has a number of other characteristics. There's always a visionary who receives the revelation and has this vision of unveiled things and then conveys that to people. The function of the genre, so for example, you go to see a romantic comedy. Why? Because you want to feel good. You go to see, you know, Lara Croft, Tomb Raider. Why? Because you just want, you know, a fantasy, you know, adventure movie. So different genres do different things to us. They make us feel different ways. They function in different ways. You go to see a documentary, you don't want to just hang loose and relax. You want to be, you want to learn something from a documentary. Hotel Rwanda, go into that movie knowing that you're going to have a different kind of experience than When Harry Met Sally, right? So that you know that particular genres do particular things. The function is my little, I steal some things from the math world, science world. So the function of apocalyptic genre is, one, to comfort, two, to challenge, and perhaps most importantly, to critique. So it's taking this from the prophetic genre that it is to critique whatever it's talking about. Sometimes that's a comfort for some of the seven churches that John is writing to. In other words, they are suffering at the hands of the empire, and to critique the empire means that they feel uplifted and comforted and supported. For others who have assimilated and bought in and they like living in the empire and they feel quite on top of things, that critique of empire will challenge them to renegotiate their faith.
Question?
Yes.
So the book was written about 70 AD?
About 90.
Okay.
Some people will put it later, up to 110. I like to keep it in the first century because it's easier for my students. Some people put it a little
close
bit
enough.
Earlier. Yeah, it's, you know,
okay.
What's 30 years in carbon dating? And know we're not carbon dating, but.
So apocalyptic genre was familiar to the people at that time. Mm-hmm. When did it become, it's not familiar to us. Mm-hmm. What happened?
We have genres that do similar things. For example, sci-fi imagines another world, takes some things from this world, puts them in a different context, and often, like Star Trek, will critique our understanding of race by showing us something that's very different, revealing a different way that the races can interact and actually looks much more human and normal and peaceful. So we have a genre that does that. Michael Moore does kind of apocalyptic critique in some ways. Maybe it's not apocalyptic. He's not using monsters so much. But it is a prophetic critique. So the prophetic genre continues, and there are other fantasy type genres that do that critique. The history of it. Scholars will argue about what its origins are. They argue that it's either a prophetic origin, so something like Isaiah, Jeremiah, prophetic critique, or that it's coming from the East, and probably both are true. There are probably influences both ways. It was very common during Jesus' time when empire was particularly oppressive in different areas, specifically in Israel. So people would use that genre. Another genre that's similar would be black gospel music, where you can't talk about the oppression that you're feeling, but you talk about swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. You're talking in symbols, and the master thinks you're talking about, oh, they're good Christians, you know, everything's fine, I'm not going to have a rebellion, nobody's going to challenge my rule over this plantation. But actually what you're saying is, Harriet Tubman's chariot's going to swing down and pick you up and take you off to up north, and you're going to get on the railroad, the Underground Railroad, and escape. So we do have genres that do this. We just, Dante's Inferno, so Middle Ages pick up a little bit on this, mm-hmm. It's kind of similar. Mm-hmm. Glenn will probably see lots of connections to mythological work in different traditions, but otherwise I don't have a good answer for you, Bonnie. It comes in and out. Paul uses pieces of it. Mark 13 is another little apocalypse from the first century.
The confusion comes when we take the dreamscape and literalize it. That's when people freak out at
precisely.
The monsters and say, oh, that's
precisely.
Ronald Reagan, or whatever. We've lost that elasticity.
You have to maintain the elasticity.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the genius of it, as I was saying yesterday. Part of the genius of Revelation is that you can't say this horn on the beast was Nero precisely. So people can apply that ambiguous symbol to later. This is Hitler, this is Ronald Reagan, this is... There's one artist who, bless you, characterizes the European Union and the currency, the United Currency, as one of the beasts. So it's pliable, it's elastic, but as soon as you literalize it, you run into trouble. So that's why it's a dreamscape. You don't want to literalize your dreams, because that would be really scary. Okay, so the socio-historical political context, around 90, around 100 in there, Asia Minor, so modern-day Turkey. We talked about the John the Visionary, or John the Seer, is having this vision, and he wants to reveal some truth about the Roman Empire to the churches he's writing to. In talking about the Roman Empire, he's going to use symbolic, dreamlike, mythological, like fantasy language. He talks about Rome as the whore and the empire as the beast. So we looked at one scene yesterday where the whore in all her luxury and excess, purple linens, gold, everything, jewels, is sitting on the beast. And there are many waters around, right? So it's a description of Rome, and by extension, the empire. He also uses the language, and this is explained in the text. Rome, the whore has written on her forehead Babylon. So instead of talking about the Roman Empire, T.O. John is drawing back on Jewish history and saying, let's talk about the Babylonian Empire so I don't get into trouble, is the easy way to say it. It's more complex than that. But he's drawing on the Babylon as the symbol for empire. And everybody in the Jewish Christian circles would have heard about the excesses of Babylon and the downfall of Babylon, right? So that's the main goal. I mean, you don't want to pick an empire that hasn't fallen yet to talk about it because you want fall. John wants Rome to fall. So he's going to talk about Babylon. And then you all, in our work, in our reading of chapter 17 and 18, read the description of the whore and the beast as an example of hubris and arrogance and excess and luxury and wealth and trade. And the list of things that are traded in this big city goes on for like almost an entire column and ends with slaves and human lives. So everything is monetized, including human beings. And it's sort of the extreme of capitalism is kind of how we were talking about it yesterday. Okay. So that's where we were. And then leaping over biofuels, we come to the next thing you need to know about the book of Revelation, which is that it has a very particular structure. Yesterday I mentioned that there are three cycles through this whole book. It's not chronological, but there are three cycles, and each of the cycles talks about the same story. And that story is God's cosmic victory over empire, or God's cosmic victory over evil. For John the Seer, empire is evil. It's the same thing. Star Wars, we're there. The evil empire. So I mentioned that, and if you want to look at it with me, I can show you where they break down. The other way that this book is structured is through worship scenes. So Barbara Rossing, if you've heard her before or read her books, she does a very good layout of the conversation between worship of God in heaven and worship of the beast on earth. And the entire book, in this other structure, seems to be contrasting what it is to worship God versus what it is to worship the beast slash empire. Okay? And for me, although John the Seer doesn't say it, this is straight out of Deuteronomy. Choose this day whom you will serve. As for me and my people, we will serve God. Right? So where's that from? Mount Sinai, the giving of the covenant, the choice of Israel to follow God and put themselves on the same path with the covenant and go there. So I think that's what these worship scenes are doing. You're going to worship God, you're going to worship the beast. You seven churches that I'm writing letters to in chapters 1 through 5 must choose what you're going to do. Okay, so what I want to look at today are, I know it's bubbly, are two pieces, and then, well, three pieces. So chapter 4, chapter 13 briefly, and chapters 21, 22, that's what we're going to look at. But here's how the structure moves. In chapter 1, you have the opening vision, where John looks over and he sees a vision of Christ and he falls down on his face. So in chapter 1, the first thing you have is the prophet worshiping this vision of Christ. That's what kicks it all off. In chapter 4, as we'll see, he gets vaulted up into heaven through this little window and witnesses how the worship is going on in heaven at that time. Chapter 13 is the contrast, worship of the beast on earth. So I want to look at that. 17 and 18 is what we looked at yesterday. It's not a worship scene, but it is liturgical. It's the funeral of Rome. So the death march, the funeral celebration for those who live in empire and want to see it fall. And then the end of Revelation chapter 21 and 22 is the wedding. And I'm hoping that's where we'll get to today. The last thing I should say that's a pickup from yesterday, because we have some new folks, is that what Revelation, that one of the key metaphors that the book of Revelation also takes from the Hebrew Bible and the prophetic tradition is a metaphor that equates idolatry with adultery. Okay? So, understood in covenantal language, Israel is covenanting with God at Sinai under Moses. And that covenant in the ancient world was both a covenant of, it was a contract. And that contract could be made between a god and a people, between, someone who's going to build a big temple and the workers, between one country and another country, between kings and kings, or between a man and a woman in marriage. So covenant had that whole stretch of meaning. So when John the Seer wants to talk about choose this day whom you will serve, the beast or God, he's recalling the prophetic idea that Israel was supposed to be the bride of God, and when Israel worshipped other gods, idolatry, Israel was playing the whore. And it's that blunt in the prophetic material. Okay, so idolatry was expressed in the human sexual metaphor of adultery. Does that make sense? Okay. Because otherwise you think, otherwise reading Revelation, it just sounds super horrible and exploitative, and that language is there, but this helps. Well, it's not up there. Understanding this metaphor, this equation of idolatry and adultery, helps get you through some of that language and have a context for it. And it also helps explain why the last liturgical pieces, right? Opening vision of worship, heavenly worship, worship of beast, and then a liturgical piece is the funeral of the whore. The death of idolatry, if you will. And then the wedding of the bride, right? So the celebration of covenantal restoration with God again. Yes, sir?
To reiterate, you've got your three cycles, same story, and that's very dreamlike too, or a dream
yes.
will show you something one way, it'll show you again a different way, it'll show you again. So that seems to
mm-hmm.
be what you're indicating. It's like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, just reiterating the main themes in different imagery.
Very much, yeah. And I know so little about Native American mythology, but dream is very important there. And so it'll be interesting to talk to you later and see how those things those concepts interweave, or that presentation interweaves. Okay, so trust me, this is an opening vision, which the prophet falls down on his face and worships God. And if you take that at face value, let's go to chapter 4 and look at the scene of heavenly worship. And what I want to do is, I didn't bring all of my slides. I didn't bring any of my slides. The book of Revelation is a very visual book. There's some Bibles up here if you want to grab them. Let me grab some more. So it shows up really well in paintings. So if you look, the way I present the book of Revelation at the university in a course on Revelation and Apocalyptic is always through art, because the artists get it. They're not literalists about it.
It's
totally right brain. So what I want to do is I want to contrast the... I picked up the same one. Oh, no, I didn't.
That's
go that one.
Heavenly worship. With the beast over here. So we'll start chapter 4. And Katie, do you want to begin reading?
Sure.
Chapter 4, 1. I think it's where we are.
After this I looked, and there before me was a door standing open in heaven. And the voice I had first heard speaking to me like a trumpet said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after this." At once I was in the Spirit.
What does that mean? Being in the Spirit that we learned yesterday?
Spirit was speaking through.
Spirit possession, in some ways, that you're occupied by the Spirit of God. Or if you want to think about it in terms of the Christmas carol, right? Scrooge is led around by the Spirit. Same thing. That's a very apocalyptic kind of piece, too. Sorry, go ahead.
At once I was in the Spirit, and there before me was a throne in heaven with someone sitting on it. And the one who sat there had the appearance of jasper and carnelian. A rainbow, resembling an emerald, encircled the throne. Surrounding the throne were 24 other thrones, and seated on them were 24 elders. They were dressed in white and had crowns of gold on their head.
Okay. Sorry, pause again.
Okay.
Why 24?
It's a multiple of 12.
Okay. Why 12 and 12?
Yeah, what?
Good. I'm quizzing the people who were here yesterday. In this book, in the apocalyptic genre, numbers do not refer to quantities, they refer to concepts. So the number 12 doesn't refer, the number 24 doesn't refer to, 20 plus 4. It's not a concrete thing. It represents two 12s coming together. And those two 12s are not 6 plus 6, they are the disciples, or the apostles, and the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, so 12 plus 12 means that for John, his audience is Jewish and Christian. And this God is the God who brings together the people of Israel with the Gentiles who are coming in, and they're all together worshiping in heaven. So just so you can understand that piece. Okay.
From the throne came flashes of lightning, rumblings, and peals of thunder. Before the throne, seven lamps were blazing. These are the seven spirits of God. Also before the throne, there was what looked like a sea of glass, clear as crystal.
Okay, so we'll stop there for a second. How would you describe this worship so far?
Magnificent, joyful and in your face, kind of.
Well, those are three very different descriptions. What's the in your face part?
Well, there's like lightning and thunder
and lamps, so it's fire hazard.
It's a fire hazard. There's a lot of
and
fire going on.
It's a light show.
It's a light show. A lot of light. Okay? What else?
A lot of things of beauty.
A lot of things of
carnelian,
beauty.
Carnelian, sea of glass.
Good. And not just visually beautiful, but economically valued as well. Mm. Yeah, I mean, maybe not a sea of glass, but that would cost a lot to put together. Value.
It's very grand and magnificent. Just there's a sense of awe, like over the top.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what you were first getting at, right? Yeah. Magnificent.
Elders overseeing it all, sounds like, on their thrones.
Uh-huh. Elders on thrones. Mm-hmm. Huh. Under the Roman Empire, did the 12 tribes or the 12 apostles have any power? And now they're seated on thrones around God. So there's your comfort, right? For people who are feeling disempowered. if they belong to some of those 12 tribes or have worked with the 12 apostles, they now are going to move up in the world, if you will. They'll have some authority there. Good. So the elders, do you hear anything?
Thunder.
Hmm? Do you feel anything?
Maybe reverence.
Okay.
Or
fear.
Some fear, some awe, some reverence.
Mm-hmm. Lots of energy.
Energy. Mm-hmm. What kind of energy?
In the form of like fire, like sound waves.
Sound waves?
Like light, I suppose.
Well, y'all at Holden know. What happens when you're standing out in a lightning storm?
The siren goes off.
The siren, the whale goes off. It gets prickly. The air gets a little prickly, a little staticky. Mm-hmm. Right? So, one of the other things about apocalyptic is that it involves all five senses. So there's some touch involved here with the sound waves and the lightning. There's definitely hearing. There's sight, definitely sight. There will be some. There is some. There's two occurrences of taste in the book. He has to eat a scroll, and it's bitter and sweet and bitter. So we'll keep going. Ryan, do you want to read? Where are we? At six, I think. Middle. Around the throne.
Around the throne, in each side of the throne, are four living creatures, full of eyes in front and behind. The first living creature like a lion, the second living creature like an ox, the third living creature with a face like a human face, and the fourth living creature like a flying eagle.
Is anybody here on Wednesday?
Ezekiel?
It's the same thing, huh?
Straight out of Ezekiel. Now, it's a little bit different. How, Casey?
It's four creatures instead of one with, like, four faces.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So in the book of Ezekiel we looked at on Wednesday, the throne of God is wheels within wheels. It's crazy. I don't know how it works, but there are four creatures, and each creature has four faces. Here, the faces each have their own body. So it's a little bit different, but it's the same creatures with different parts. That makes sense. So it should recall, for those who knew the prophetic tradition, should recall Ezekiel's vision of the throne in Babylon, right? Because Ezekiel was in Babylon. And what happened? Babylon fell, and Ezekiel got to take the people back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. And God came back. Right? So just in that one little, these four creatures, you have that weight of history and association coming in too. For those who were listening who had that background. Okay, sorry, Ryan.
And the four living creatures, each of them with six wings, are full of eyes all around and inside. Day and night, without ceasing, they sing, "Holy, holy, holy, the Lord God Almighty, who was and is to come." And whenever the living creatures give glory and honor and thanks to the one who is seated on the throne, who lives forever and ever, the 24 elders fall before the one who is seated on the throne and worship the one who lives forever and ever. They cast their crowns before the throne, singing, "You are worthy, our Lord and God, to receive glory and honor and power. For you created all things, and by your will they existed and were created."
Mm-hmm. Do you notice anything else in there?
Well, there's the who was and is and is to come. And they have the beast later, who was and is not.
Right? So again, that contrast between worshiping God, who was and is to come, versus the beast, who was and is not and is still coming, or, it's twisted around, but with a negation in there.
Mm-hmm. Full of eyes.
full of eyes, the same as the Ezekiel passage.
Eyes on the inside.
Eyes on the inside.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Eyes on the inside.
That's creepy.
So what do you think of that? The eye imagery, or whether is he alluding to or getting out or trying to illustrate?
What do you think?
Sees everything.
I think of eyes as intelligence or perspective. But there's always so many meanings, so.
Right.
Where do you go with that?
Yeah, I think I go that way, and the way Brent was going, which is all seeing. Sight, as you're alluding to, we talk about, oh, I see, I get it, is knowing. So intelligence and knowledge comes with that metaphor of sight. The concrete is this physical seeing, and the metaphorical is the understanding or the comprehension.
Mm-hmm.
It also externally symbolizes God's prescience, God's all-seeingness and God's all-knowingness, but it's outside of God in one of the creatures. I just read Madeleine L'Engle and it throws me back into the cherubim in The Wind and the Door. So I don't know if any of you know that. No? All right, well, lots of eyes. Eyes are the window to the soul. Eyes are how you get through things. So the eye of the needle is where you put the thread through. And John has just gone up through a little window into heaven to see new things. Apocalypse means revealing, opening, seeing. So you have, I think, any resonance you find is there. You can't always say that, but I think he's really playing with that. Have you ever heard these words? You are worthy, our Lord God, to receive glory and honor.
Very liturgical.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The church has preserved that liturgical phrasing even to today. So it should still resonate with worshipers in a Christian tradition. The holy, 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 we often sing that in the communion liturgy.
This might be too analytical, but I just think it's interesting that in verse 9-10, it says, whenever living creatures give glory to God, the elders fall down and worship Him. Like,
and what do they do?
Bow.
And?
Cast their crowns.
Cast their crowns on the floor. What is Rome not doing?
It's not casting down its crown.
Remember how you described Rome yesterday?
Being proud and arrogant.
Self-sufficient, needing no one. Right? But these elders are given authority. They have crowns and thrones, but they know their place in relation to God. And Rome did not know her place in relation to God. In fact, Rome gets deified as its own God. That city becomes God. Yeah. So no, not too analytical. Is that where you were going?
Well,
what else?
Just that it's not the leaders who are bound first. It's the creatures.
Creatures around.
The rest of the living creatures.
Uh-huh. They are, yeah. I hadn't thought about that. It may be because the creatures are always heavenly and the elders are human coming to worship.
Mm-hmm.
So they're following suit. I don't know. I hadn't thought about that one. Okay. Chapter 13.
Casey, do you want to read?
And And I saw a beast rising out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on its horns were 10 diadems, and on its head were blasphemous names. And the beast that I saw was like a leopard. Its feet were like a bear's, and its mouth was like a lion's mouth. And the dragon gave it his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have received a death blow, but its mortal wound had been healed. In amazement, the whole earth followed the beast. They worshipped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?"
Okay, pause there. Anything strike you here? Where's the beast come from?
The
sea.
What do you know about the sea this week in biblical study?
Babylonians worship the sea monsters.
Right? And when we on Monday when we looked at our Genesis 1, the priests who are recovering some of the liturgy in Babylon under oppression by the Babylonians talk about God creating the sea monsters. Or maybe that was Genesis 2 and 3. But God creates the sea monsters. So they are not equal to God. They are created. And so here, it's the idolatrous, right? The gods of other people that are rising out of the sea. And so Rome is imaged here as the pagan place again, the place of many gods that come with power and authority and take over. But they're also rising out of the sea, which is where Rome comes from when it comes to conquer you if you are in that area. I think, was it a third of the year or two-thirds of the year? The Mediterranean is the easiest way to get from place to place in Northern Africa, Israel, Turkey, Greece, Italy, so Spain. It's the easiest way to get places. So Rome is the one that comes by the sea. Yeah. Anything else?
I'm wondering about the significance of one of the heads received a death blow and
and a mortal wound, right?
Image.
So if you have a an edited Bible. Mine says the note on 13:3 is one of its heads received a death blow, comma. The Emperor Nero, who committed suicide in 68, reflects a widespread belief in Nero's return from death. So that the expectation was sort of like Elvis. Nero's coming back. Nero's still alive. Nero, where is he? He was so horrible, and he may be around again. So it received a death blow, but maybe it's not dead. It's the sort of like your basic horror movie.
Yeah.
You think you killed the beast and it's still coming after you. Okay. All right, who wants to read? Anybody want to take up the next piece?
I'll do it.
You want to do it? Great.
Verse 5?
Verse 5, I think, yeah.
The beast was given a mouth uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming his name and his dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. It was given authority over every tribe and people and language and nation, and all the inhabitants of the earth will worship it. Everyone whose name has not been written from the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slaughtered.
Okay, we'll pause there. All the inhabitants of the earth will worship it. At this time, people thought the Roman Empire went from horizon to horizon. It covered everything they knew. What's going on in verses 7 and 8?
It says it like almost like it was. It says it was given authority. Well, given by whom? By God? Like,
yeah.
Is that?
I'm allowed to make war.
Yeah.
So why? I mean, pretty much in the Bible, anytime you have the passive tense, it's It's God did it.
Right. To show that God is powerful.
Yes.
And that.
Mm-hmm. Rome would not have any power because without God saying, okay, fine, take a little time to do what you need to do. Because God is in control, ultimately, in this genre, in this apocalyptic genre. God governs everything, orders everything. And so evil or beasts or tyrants are given authority for a time, but it's always a limited time. I mean, it's not ongoing. So this is indicating that, yeah. Good.
Julie, can I ask,
yeah.
Your definition of blasphemy is not a word I use very often.
Yeah. Blasphemy you can receive a death sentence for blasphemy in a number of cultures or religions, and certainly in ancient Israel.
To malign God or
to malign God.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To say that God is not God. To deny who God is. Or to do something that denies who God is. Bless you. So, if we go back here, I am self-sufficient could be blasphemous. Jesus is charged with blasphemy when he, especially in the Gospel of John, where he often says, I'm going to my Father. And they're like, you mean God? You're calling yourself God? That's blasphemy, to call yourself God. Or to call yourself independent of God and not recognize in humility a reliance on God would also be a blasphemous.
Or I and the Father are one, and
yes.
Misinterpreted,
yes.
Or heard.
Well, it was a blasphemous statement,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. As John wrote it down.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he was doing that intentionally in that gospel. Yes, sir.
Blasphemy is also would come, I think, from the Roman emperors who claimed to be divine.
Yes.
Yeah.
Good.
As well.
Good.
Yeah,
good connection.
Say worship me because I'm it.
Yeah. And usually the emperors didn't declare themselves gods. They didn't. Pharaohs did, but the emperors didn't usually. They were usually declared worshipable after they had passed, and their son or the next one coming on collected more power for himself by legitimating the emperor that went before. So, and often that was his father or his uncle or something like that.
So what about the number 42? You said,
yeah.
7 is completeness and 6 is incomplete.
Oh, yeah. So what verse is 42 in?
42.
Verse 5.
Authority for 42 months. 42 months, see note on 11.2. It helps to have them. 11.2 says, the trampling or subjugation of Jerusalem by the nations, that is the Gentiles, is a common eschatological motif. Oh, whoops, sorry. That's irrelevant. 42 months. For example, 1,260 days, or 3.5 years, is a metaphorical period of eschatological distress.
Okay.
So, again, conceptual, not chronological. So a period of eschatological distress are the 42 months that this beast will be.
And that would have been culturally relevant. Again, it's kind of like an illusion that the people reading it at the time, that would resonate to them. It's
mm-hmm.
like,
mm-hmm.
it's like what Book of Daniel has similar.
Precisely. Right. And that's where the editor sends you.
Right.
Says,
so,
the Book of Daniel uses 42 all the time.
Okay.
And where was Daniel? Babylon. It wasn't written during Babylonian times. It was written much later, projecting back into Babylonian times and contrasting Daniel with Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon, and how did the people survive that occupation. Okay, so again, I'm over. It's quarter of.
We need to get to the wedding.
We're going to get there right now. We're going to go fast, mm-hmm. but I know people may have to leave. So, the worship of the beast, arrogant, limited, ugly, still multiple creatures. Both of the worships are scary, right? And not comprehensible immediately, like eyes on the inside, leopard paws and bear head, or whatever it is. So they're both meant to call you out of your reality to see something in a new way. That's the function, critique. See something in a new way so you'll change your behavior. So let's go to, we're going to skip 17 and 18. Remember, that's the funeral of Rome. And now we get to 21 for the wedding. I know, I'm jumping. That was lots of weeping. Chapter 21, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth. So the I is always John here, John the seer. Different from John the gospel writer, not the same person, although possibly in the same geographical area. Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more, no more sea monsters. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. What's the parallel?
Idolatry.
Yeah. We're back there again. So the idolatrous, adulterous city, Rome, is dead. And now this heavenly bride, Jerusalem, is coming down from earth. Barbara Rossing makes a big deal about the direction here. The Left Behind series, for example, or the rapture conversation, is always raptured out of the earth. So this, you know, Brent, your conversation partners who say, well, we can use the earth, it was given to us, and we'll just use it up because another one's coming, it's going to be over. Mm-mm. Revelation never says people will be zapped off of the earth. It's not in the book of Revelation. It's an invention that misreads Paul and 13th century visionaries or whatever it is, 17th century, I forget. In the book of Revelation, God brings a city down to earth. So it's like planting a garden and putting Adam in it again in Genesis 2 and 3. God's going to bring the city down, plant it on the earth, and call all the nations, not send Adam and Eve out of it, but call all the nations to. So it's a very different trajectory than the rapture theology that some Christians embrace. I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, see, the home of God is among mortals. God will dwell with them. They will be God's peoples. And God, God's self, will be with them. God will wipe every tear from their eye. Death will be no more. Mourning and crying and pain will be no more. For the first things have passed away. Any resonances? Oh, you who were here for Genesis at the beginning of the week. What are Adam and Eve cursed with?
Death.
Pain. Toil, suffering, pain in childbirth. What does it say? Death will be no more. Mourning, crying, pain will be no more. So it's a reversal of the getting kicked out of the garden. And the one who is seated on the throne said, see, I'm making all things new. Also, he said, write this, for these words are trustworthy and true. And then he said to me, it is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. To the thirsty I will give water as a gift from a spring of the water of life. I will be their God, they will be my children, and then these other people won't be able to come in. Then, in verse 9, one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven last plagues came and said to me, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb. Who's the Lamb?
Jesus.
Good. We didn't read the vision of the Lamb, but the Lamb is Christ. And it's a Lamb who in this vision of Revelation is standing as if it were slain. So there's another dreamscape piece for you, right? Can you imagine a Lamb standing but slain, right? So it's, you know, crucified but standing. And he's not talking about, you know, sort of like the chickens where they keep going after they've been killed. This one was killed and brought back to life and is still powerful. But the marks of the crucifixion are in the lamb.
Where does it say the lamb was slain?
It doesn't. It's in another place. It's not in this passage. So in another place, the lamb who stands as if it was slain. Is
in Revelation.
Yeah. Chapter 13, verse 8.
Thank you. Yeah. So you can go look at that. And in the spirit, so he's spirit possessed again, the angel carried me away to a great high mountain. Mountains are important. What mountain imagery do you have from the Bible?
Moses
going up to Mount Sinai.
Moses on Mount Sinai.
Mount Calvary.
Jesus on the mountaintop. What else?
Mount Calvary.
Uh-huh. The crucifixion and the Sermon on the Mount. So both of those mountains. Yep. Elijah going up and hiding on the mountain until the voice of God the stillness calls him out. So lots of mountains. Mountains are revelatory. It's where you get a vision. It's where you encounter God. It's where you, right, something important happens. So the angel takes John the seer up to a mountain, showed me the holy city of Jerusalem coming down out of the heaven from God. He just told us this. So now he's recycling. He's telling us again from a different perspective. It has the glory of God and radiance like a rare jewel, like jasper, clear as crystal. It has a great high wall with 12 gates, and it's going to go on with a long description. In verse 14, 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. Okay. So again, Revelation is self-referential. It will define some of these numbers as it goes along. The angel who talked to me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. So now there's going to come a big long description. And sapphire, agate, emerald, onyx, carnelian, chrysolite, beryl, topaz. What does that remind you of?
Rome's wealth.
Rome's wealth that fell.
Yeah.
And then the heavenly throne room. Right? So Rome's wealth is gone. Now the heavenly wealth is coming down to the earth and will be a part of this wedding gift of Jerusalem. Verse 22 of chapter 21. I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty, and the Lamb. The city has no need of sun or moon to shine on it, for the glory of God is its light, and its lamp is the Lamb. The nations will walk by its light, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. Its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. Why did you shut city gates?
Keep the barbarians out.
Keep you safe. Keep the people out.
Especially at night.
Especially at night. God didn't need to keep the people out, so the gates are always open. It's an eternal hospitality, if you will. People will bring into it glory, the glory and honor of the nations. The nations is also Gentiles. But nothing unclean will enter it, nor anyone who practices abominations or falsehood. Only those who are written in the Lamb's Book of Life. All right. Who wants to read 22? The rest of the wedding vision. Okay. Great. Thanks, Nathan.
Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb through the middle of the street of the city. On either side of the river is the tree of life with its 12 kinds of fruit, producing its fruit each month, and the leaves of the tree for the healing of the nations. Nothing accursed will be found there anymore, but the throne of God and of the Lamb will be in it, and his servants will worship him. They will see his face, and his name will be on their foreheads. And there will be no more night. They need no light of lamp or sun, for the Lord God will be their light, and he will reign forever and ever.
Good. This is a lot like the picture I drew of the Garden of Eden on Tuesday. For those of you who weren't here, you can go back and read just the beginning of Genesis 2, verse 4, following probably 4 through 10 or something like that. But you have the throne that is the source of the river of life that flows through the city. Anybody been to Turkey or Greece? The ancient cities usually had this aqueduct that would bring the water out of the mountains, and it's cantilevered and set all the right ways. And then it flows down, and then it flows down the center of the road, of the main road that is through the city. So it basically comes down, the water comes down out of the mountains, makes this pretty little stream all the way through, and goes all the way out the gates of the city. And then people would come in that way, and off of that main road, you would have the marketplace, you would have the government, you would have all that stuff. So this is imagined according to human understandings of what cities were at the time. But the source of the life, the source of the river of life, the seas have disappeared, remember? So the water that comes to feed the land is from the throne of God. And then...
from the mountain.
And the mountain where God is. Very nice. Yeah, nice connection. I hadn't thought of that. And then the tree grows on both sides. And which tree is it?
Tree of life.
Tree of life. Which one Adam, did Adam and Eve not get to eat? That one. They chose the tree of knowledge. They ate that one, and then they knew stuff, and then they had to go off into civilization where they knew stuff and could put stuff together. But now, the close of the canon is sort of this, it's not a rewind return, but it's a return in the sense of coming back full circle to Genesis. And now, the garden that God planted still has a river running through it, still has the tree of life in the center, but there's no need for this tree of knowledge anymore. That's not even mentioned. And then what kind of fruit does it have?
12 kinds.
One for every tribe, one for every month of the year. This isn't a tree that only, you know, you can only get apples in the fall, unless you get them from Chile. You know? This is the bride, the garden, the city that is offered to be the covenant partner of God. And then all the nations, everybody in the world that they know of, is invited to come in to this vision, to this garden. So we have no time for discussion, but I'm happy to sit here and have discussion. And folks who want to head to dinner need to head to dinner. Great. Thoughts?
Bell didn't ring yet.
The bell didn't ring. Oh, good. We have 30 seconds.
Verse 18, I don't know if you want to touch on this, but is the warning.
Mm-hmm. 18:22? No.
21:18? Yeah, that was the last chapter.
22:18.
Oh. Yeah, I warn everyone who hears the words of the prophecy.
Oh,
yeah. If anyone adds to them, God will add to that person the plagues described in this book and takes away. You know, that's pretty dramatic.
Yeah. And pretty common to any text that had secret knowledge in it. So any medieval text, these are some, I have medieval historians on either side of my office at school, and they love the medieval text because they always say, may your very important parts fall off and may you be burned forever if you change any words in this book.
Oh,
but they say it in fancy languages. Yeah. So
this is boilerplate for this drama.
This is boilerplate for...
Now we have copyright protection.
See, yes.
It'll sue you.
But now with the internet, we may have to go back to the curses.
Once it digitizes it.
Yeah, it's over. Yeah. But good question, Bonnie. It sounds very stark and scary.
So don't mess with that.
Yeah, don't mess with it. But it's interesting to me because people expand this prohibition to the entire Bible, right? They're thinking about the scripture canonically rather than individual writings. And of course, in the Christian faith, you do both. You go back and forth. You go individual writing and whole canon, back and forth. But it
sounds kind of out of place, though.
It seems out of place?
Kind of. It ends up like verse 17, the Spirit and the Bride say, come, and let everyone who hears say, come, and let everyone who is thirsty come, and everyone who wishes take the water of life as a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And then, bam, I warn anyone, everyone who hears.
Sure.
Like in my Bible class at school, like we talked about different verses that sounded very like implanted,
yeah,
from the Council of Nicaea
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And like, do you think
mm-hmm.
that's a possibility that could be? Which should be really
I would say that goes with my description of it as boilerplate.
What do you mean by that?
The piece of text that's very standard that you have to insert into
uh-huh.
something.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. And so scholars who do this kind of manuscript work, it's called source, looking at the sources, take both of what you're saying. I like to read them as they exist now. I don't like to go back and figure out which ones imported and which ones didn't. I think that's very useful for some things, but it's still in there.
Mm-hmm.
And people still think it's sacred. So you still have to wrestle with it, even if it was imported. Like, the women be silent, people want to take that out of 1 Corinthians and just say, oh, that's a later insert. But yeah, but it's still in there and people read it. Historically, it helps to figure that out. They can't figure it out definitively, which pieces were inserted when, because we don't have the manuscript evidence many times. What the editors of this New Testament have done, and any New Testament you pick up, is translated from a Greek text that tries to get the most original reading. So it has taken out a lot of the glosses, a lot of the additional things that we can see from the manuscript tradition were not part of the original. So when people talk about inserts from Nicaea, they're going back pre-manuscript evidence. And probably the extant manuscripts that we have contain everything that is here. Which means it's hypothetical what was added.
Or detracted that we never
mm-hmm.
had access to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And yet, at the same time, it's helpful to say, yeah, you know what? There's a shift here in the flow of things, and my college teacher would not permit that. So what happened there? Another thing to remember is that this would always have been presented orally. It wasn't to be read. So the person who was reading the letter or reading Revelation was trained in oral presentation and would have known where to pause, where to shift, where to, you can think of it as more a theatrical presentation.
Right.
Mm-hmm. They would have helped you as the hearer transition in those awkward spaces.
Because
mm-hmm.
it's
kind
of like a PS, which you would
yes.
abbreviate with some a dramatic pause.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Or like in a TV commercial for some sort of medicine,
uh-huh.
they have the sotto voce thing at
mm-hmm.
the end where they give the side effects
yeah.
of it.
Yeah, and speed it up.
Yeah.
What
yeah. yeah.
so
did
I say?
That's
really fast.
Oh my gosh, you could die.
Yeah.
Well, let's have a word of prayer, and if people want to hang out and chat, we can do that, and otherwise we'll launch to dinner. Gracious God, we thank you for what you revealed to us. We thank you for the glimpses and the windows into both your word and our experience, our relationship to the world and government and all of the things going on in this time period that we are born into. I ask that you would bring understanding to all of our hearts and minds and to let the reflections that we've had here resonate and increase and grow in us as we learn more and more. We give thanks for your spirit and your presence among us. And we ask you to bless all of the hands and the minds and hearts who come in and out of Holdenville.